stand here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and, of course, the views of our callers, but we're going to ask you not to call this evening, unless we specifically ask for callers, because we have with us online Pastor David Whitney from the Institute of the Constitution, and we're going to be talking about the amazing document that makes America different from other countries. People will try to equate our heritage with the Statue of Liberty. That's not our heritage at all. That was actually given to us by France, by revolutionaries who wanted to use America to bring about a new world order and to alter our form of government. America, all of our traditions are based upon our Constitution, our Declaration of Independence, and our Bill of Rights that makes America different than any other country and is a terrible hindrance to those who would establish an all-powerful government and take away our freedom. Now, there are people today who do not believe in America, who are globalists, and they've already controlled so much of our media and controlled so much of our government. But they fear being labeled as, criminals for violating the Constitution, and it is simply this document that, at least for the time being, preserves our heritage of freedom. So with that as a background, Pastor David Whitney of the Institute on the Constitution, thank you so very much for being with us again.
Oh, it's my privilege always to be on your shows, and I appreciate your listeners. I had a letter from one, I think it was in Brooklyn this week, who was asking some specific questions that our talks on the air here had spurred him to think more deeply about the Constitution. I'm always grateful for that, because that's our purpose. We know that if America is going to be recovered, if we're going to take it back from the one-worlders and restore the republic, it begins with, doesn't end with, but it begins with educating millions of Americans about our founding and our founding documents and what they meant, what the authors of those documents, the Declaration, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, what they meant by the exact words they used. And they had a very specific and unchanging meaning. Not a living, breathing document, as we've been lied to and told that what their intention was. It was not that at all. It was a fixed standard that they did not see would alter except by a specific means. And tonight we're going to talk about that in Article 5 of the Constitution. Just to step back for a moment and review where we have been over the course of many months, Article 1 talks about the legislative branch, its powers, and again, a very limited number of powers specified there in Article 1, Section 8. Every American ought to know that that Article 1, Section 8 list is the only things that the federal government is permitted to do. Nothing more than what's on that list.
Now, that's legally. Of course, they do a lot of things that they shouldn't do. In other words, these men who swore to uphold the Constitution, most of them don't even understand what it says and don't understand that most of the legislation being enacted by our federal government today is a violation of the very statutes of that Constitution that they supposedly are upholding.
And so these lawmakers, the legislators, are really lawbreakers because, as we will discover tonight, the supreme law of the land is the United States Constitution. Well, the Article 1 deals with the legislature. Article 2 deals with the executive branch and the president and his cabinet. Article 3 deals with the judiciary, the Supreme Court, and any lower federal courts beneath that. And as we saw last time, Article 4 deals with relations between the states, full faith and credit, and perhaps one of the most important clauses in Article 4 is that the United States guarantees that each state shall have a republican government.
I'm sorry, we missed our break there. You go right ahead.
Okay, that a republican form of government, that is a representative form of government with absolute fixed laws, founded and established on the laws of nature and nature's God. And that is one of the most important phrases in Article 4. When we come to Article 5, really, in a sense, the humility of our founders was being expressed here in Article 5 because they recognized that they couldn't necessarily get it perfectly right for all generations and all times. That there might be things that they put into the structure of government that later on would need to be altered and need to be amended. And so they provided in Article 5 a way in which our government could change and be altered. And it specifically stated that it is only by this means, by the amendment process, that our form of government is to be altered. For example, George Washington in his farewell address, which, by the way, is the most important political statement ever made in our country, used to be the required reading of every high school student to read and understand the things that George Washington warned of and the things that he urged us to attend to as citizens in this land in order to preserve our constitutional republic. The reason it is no longer read, the reason it's no longer studied, and the reason most Americans have never even heard of George Washington's farewell address is it is very clearly a Christian exhortation to godliness and righteousness and to upholding God's standards. And those sort of things are politically incorrect, and nobody wants to hear about them today. They think, oh, you know, our form of government runs on autopilot. We don't need to do much of anything. Very, very contrary to what our founders clearly stated. And his statement here about the amendment process is very important to consider. He said in his farewell address, if in the opinion of the people, the distribution or modifications of the constitutional powers be in any particular wrong, that is, if we made a mistake when we put together this Constitution and how we distributed the powers or how we modified things, if it be in the wrong, let it be corrected by an amendment in the way which the Constitution designates. But let there be no change by usurpation, for though this in one instance may be the instrument of good, it is the customary weapon by which free governments are destroyed. Here George Washington was saying, anyone who attempts to amend or change our form of government except by this amendment process of Article 5 of the Constitution is a usurper, or another term would be for them, they are a tyrant. That is, they take to them powers, themselves powers, that they
hold
do
that
not...
Hold that thought right there, David, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest is Pastor David Whitney, and he's simply talking about amending the Constitution. Our founding fathers laid out a pattern by which the Constitution could be amended. Now, you have to understand that we have the oldest Constitution in the world today, and no other government has had the continuity for the last 200 or more years that we've had here. Our founding fathers did not want it to be easy to amend the Constitution. They wanted it to be difficult, but if there was something that had to be done, it could be done, and it's been done a number of times through the years. But what they did not want was for any group of men, like members of the Supreme Court, to be able to alter our form of government by judicial action, or they did not want, certainly, the people within the legislative or the executive branch to take powers that were not given unto them simply by edict. And, of course, this was the thing. If you want to change our form of government, then you've got to amend it. We are not a living, breathing document. Our Constitution is a fixed document that is amended with difficulty, but it can be amended, and that was the genius of our form of government. And, of course, the one thing our founding fathers feared was that men are corrupt. Men are sinful. That's what the Bible says. They believe the Bible. Men cannot be trusted with power. Or, as Thomas Jefferson had said so well, you know, bind them down for mischief with the chains of the Constitution. So, go ahead, then.
And so, looking at George Washington's statement there and his warning to us, is he's basically saying, beware of anyone who would seek to change the form of government except by that legitimate means, that is, Article 5 amendment process. If they're seeking to change our form of government by any other means, these people are usurpers, taking powers to themselves that they do not rightly have. These are tyrants. These are people extremely dangerous that you should protect yourselves against. Well, as we look at the history of America, we see in the last 100 to 150 years enormous violations of this principle of the Constitution. We're going to look at the details of Article 5 here in a moment. But just to make it clear, this principle of the amendment being the only way we can change our form of government has been run over so many times that people now assume it's proper, that it is legitimate for our Supreme Court to change our form of government, because after all, isn't that what they're appointed for? If you listen to the hearings in the Senate, considering various, well, Alito and so on, and Roberts, the attitude was, well, we want to question you very severely here, because once you get beyond this process of our Senate hearings, and you are impaneled as a judge, and begin to function as a judge for life, as they said repeatedly, there's no check, there's no control, there's no other way that you can be held accountable for your actions in that position as the Supreme Court, which is, as we studied in the third article, completely against our form of government. The Supreme Court is not unaccountable. There's a legislative branch that is to hold it accountable, and so on. So in other words, the attitude of most people in power in Washington, D.C. today is that the Constitution no longer matters. They have created a new Constitution, an unwritten one, however, and one that is basically a secret unless they reveal bits and pieces of it to you, that the President has powers way beyond anything that Article 2 permitted him to have, that Congress takes powers to itself way beyond Article 1, Section 8, and the Supreme Court likewise. So they have changed our form of government, and you can hear that in most of their speeches. What are they talking about? Democracy, democracy, democracy. We're over there in Iraq to make a democracy, and we're fighting all these terrorists in order to make a democracy. Well, our founders, we know, said democracy is the worst form of government, the most dangerous form of government. We have a republic here, and the whole purpose of this Constitution is to preserve a constitutional republic.
And, you know, I think it's so interesting. They often quote Winston Churchill, who said democracy is the worst form of government except for all others. And, of course, that, of course, is the lie. Winston Churchill was a Druid. He was a Mason. And Winston Churchill has always had a good press, despite his violent anti-Semitic remarks published in the New York Times in the past. So why did he always have a good press? Because he was part of the problem. He was part of the ruling establishment, part of the secret circle. That was his term. And, you know, of course, he is, of course, saying a democracy is the worst form of government, except for all others. And why didn't he mention the republic? The republican form of government that we have, it having nothing to do with the Republican Party, believe me, especially the way they're acting today. But the republic is the finest form of government. It was derived from the government of ancient Rome, when Rome was a republic and was a great nation, before it became an empire like America is becoming today. Go ahead.
So what has taken place, if you listen closely to the politicians and those power brokers today, they have, and they are operating under a different form of government. They have altered our form of government, and they have done it illegitimately, and they have done it illegally, which means they are law breakers. Now, that's a big concept, I know, for most Americans to think of the people in power in Washington, D.C., wearing black robes and attending Congress and sitting on 1600 Pennsylvania, that these people are lawbreakers. How do we know they're lawbreakers? If we study the Constitution and compare it to their day-to-day activities as leaders of our country, they are breaking the supreme law of the land every single day with almost every action and every opinion and every judicial opinion, as well as executive order, all of these things. Again and again, they have changed our form of government. The way they've gotten away with this, Dr. Stan, is that most Americans don't know that there's only one legitimate legal way to change our form of government, and that is the amendment process. Any other way is illegitimate, and when they do it, they're lawbreakers, and we the people, are the only ones that have the power to enforce the Constitution and enforce a conformance to the Constitution, and only permit those to take office who will abide by the Constitution and remove all others from office. Well, let's look at the details of Article 5, because it is so important to understand that this is the only way our form of government can be altered. There was two means by which the amendment process would take place. The first was by the approval of the particular amendment by two-thirds of both houses of Congress, so both the House of Representatives and the Senate. Two-thirds would have to vote and say, yes, we approve of this amendment, and then that amendment would be sent to the states. The second means of bringing about amendment process is by the state legislatures appealing to Congress. If two-thirds of the state legislatures around the country appealed to Congress and demanded that Congress called a constitutional convention for proposing amendments, that would then put Congress in position where, according to the Constitution, they had to call such a convention. And whichever means of those two were to be used, the amendment, once it was passed through that process, must be ratified by three-quarters of the states. And that can be ratified by either the state legislatures voting on that particular amendment, or each state may hold a ratifying convention where they consider that amendment. Congress, of course, is the one given the power by the Constitution to direct which route would take place, either legislative route or a ratifying convention in each of those states. So it's important to realize that there's, as you said earlier, a very difficult process. You've got to get two-thirds of senators and two-thirds of the House of Representatives to agree to it. Then it goes to the states, and three-quarters of those states must also agree and ratify that amendment. We have examples here in just the past couple of decades of proposed amendments that made it through Congress, that is two-thirds of the Senate and two-thirds of the House voted and said, yes, this is an amendment, and they sent it to the states, but three-quarters of the states did not sign on. An example would be the Equal Rights Amendment. It passed through both houses of Congress, but never received three-quarters of the votes needed from the state legislatures to actually ratify it. And so it has expired because Congress built into that particular proposed amendment a time limit after which, if three-quarters of the states had not ratified it, then it would not become part of our Constitution. Now, we've amended the Constitution 27 times by the first route, that is, by Congress, two-thirds of Congress, proposing an amendment, passing it through, and sending it to the state legislatures for their ratification process. We've never used the second means, and we'll talk about some good reasons why we haven't in a few moments. But to mention the 27 amendments, 10 of those were done all at once. That's the Bill of Rights. And as we discussed in the ratification of the Constitution, when the states began to debate whether to ratify the Constitution, one of the greatest objections to the Constitution was a lack of Bill of Rights, securing such things as freedom of religion, freedom of the press, freedom of speech, and so on. Lack of a Bill of Rights for many of the anti-federalists, that's the group who were opposed to the Constitution, it was a death knell. They said, we will not ratify it. And so the response was, yes, we will have a Bill of Rights. And so shortly after the ratification was complete, a Bill of Rights was considered by Congress and whittled down to ultimately 12 amendments, 10 of which actually passed together. So you could say, although it's been amended 27 times, 10 of those times took place all at once with a Bill of Rights. The other 17 are spread over the history of our nation. Now think of that for a moment. That's an astonishing fact. 230 years we've been in existence as a nation, and for 220 plus of those, we've been under this Constitution, and it's only been changed basically 18 times. One time, 10 changes all at once with the Bill of Rights, and then another 17 times. That's an astonishing record.
And of course, one of the amendments we had to rescind. So we had prohibition, right, and then we took away prohibition, mm-hmm, as an amendment to the Constitution. So it really is an amazing document. It has provided more freedom and more prosperity for more people than any other document that has ever been written. It has unharnessed man's great initiative. At least it did until government began expanding its power and began destroying education, began destroying industry, began destroying the practice of medicine, began destroying the very soul of the American people. And that's why we need to get back to the Constitution and preserve it for generations yet unborn. Go ahead, David.
Well, just compare that with a nation like France, which in the course of 50 years changed its constitution, not just amended, changed the entire form of government multiple times, 10, 20 times in the course of several decades there, between Napoleon and the French Revolution, all those things taking place. it's quite a stark contrast with the stability that our Constitution has given us, and as a result of that kind of stability of the government being unchanged, America has been an economic powerhouse up until the past several decades.
And, of course, I think the other real reason, one reason why we had a much different outlook than other countries is because we were a Christian nation. In other words, our people were primarily Christian. They had a fairly common heritage. They came from the same parts of the world. Most of them did. They had the same language. But, of course, those people who would destroy America want a multicultural, multilingual society. And when I go into as I did, you know, traveling here this last a week, why, you go, of course, into the airports, announcements are made in Spanish. You get on some of the planes, the announcements are made in Spanish. Why? Because they want a multilingual nation. That way they can play one group against the other. Those wicked people who want to establish a dictatorship know exactly what they're doing. They just don't want the American people to know. So pick up the story there.
Well, looking at the other route for amending the Constitution, where the states would appeal to Congress and two-thirds of the states would say, we need to call for a convention, there's a great blessing that God has preserved us from that route, particularly in our day, because there's several dangers that today, maybe not in earlier eras of time, but today would present themselves if a new convention was called. You see, the Constitution does not specify how delegates would be selected for that convention or what the rules of procedure would be followed in that convention, and probably what it would mean is Congress would determine those things. Furthermore, and perhaps most important of all, there's no guarantee that the delegates to this new convention would share the framers' view of human nature or their fear of centralized government power. You see, our founders, as we've talked about before, they had a Christian worldview of law and government, an understanding of man's basic nature as sinful and therefore not to be trusted with power but all sorts of checks and balances. Well, today, there's no assurance that you gather a group of average Americans that they would share that view and share that fear of centralized government power that our founders had, which is why our Constitution has been so successful until it's being dismantled under our very noses in this day. Furthermore, there's really no assurance that if a convention was called, that it could be limited to a single amendment. Let's say, okay, people want to amend the Constitution for a right to life amendment. Well, that's fine, but you know, the right to life is really already preserved in the Declaration, and if the Declaration were being followed, the basic purpose for which government exists is to protect our God-given right to life. Therefore, abortion would be illegal, you know, on its face, and the Fifth Amendment. There's a whole bunch of arguments along that line. So, but there are those who are calling for an amendment to the Constitution so that there's a right to life amendment, and if they did this through the states, and the states called for a convention, and a convention were to come together, there's nothing to limit that convention from saying, well, you know, we want more than the right to life. We want to do this and that, and we want... Actually, let's propose an entire new constitution. See, the only example we have is what happened when a convention was called...
Hold that thought right there, please, David. Hold there.
Sure.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest is Pastor David Whitney at the Institute of the Constitution. And we're really talking about really the amendment process to our amazing Constitution, a document that has been the envy of people throughout the world for 200 years until recently, when, of course, our leaders began to undermine and really shred the very concepts which were handed down to us from generations to the past. This idea of limiting the power of government over the lives of the people so men could be free. Our founders realized that liberty and limited government were synonymous. They recognized that tyranny and total government are synonymous. And as we see them expanding the surveillance of the individuals in this United States, oh, of course, in the name of fighting wicked Osama bin Laden, who's hiding in a cage over there, or a cave someplace, or maybe, maybe, as I believe, he's probably been dead for some time, but it really doesn't matter. I saw him just on television the other night, so he must be alive, and the CIA keeps claiming he's alive. That's why we've got to give up our freedom. And step by step, they take away our freedom in the name of fighting the wicked Osama bin Laden. So pick up the story there, David.
Well, as I was saying, the only example we have of what would happen when a convention is called is what happened when our Constitution was formed. They were given the task of amending the Articles of Confederation and quickly discovered they really couldn't accomplish that because Rhode Island wouldn't show up, and it took all 13 states to agree to amend anything in the Articles of Confederation. So they realized that they were up against a brick wall, and they proposed a whole new Constitution. Well, what would happen today if an entirely new Constitution were proposed? Again, if the delegates to that Constitution were not Christian, well, let me go beyond just saying that they were not Christian, because there's many Christians who have the wrong view of law and government, an unbiblical view of law and government. Let's say the only way we would have any safety whatsoever is if it were those who only hold to a biblical worldview of law and government. And we know the wicked in power today would never permit that to happen. And so a new convention would be a rather dangerous thing. And it's interesting, James Madison, who's rightly called the father of the Constitution because of his enormous influence on shaping the entire convention as well as the agenda and the elements of our Constitution. James Madison said this a year after the Constitutional Convention had closed in 1788. He said, "Having witnessed the difficulties and dangers experienced by the first convention, which assembled under every propitious circumstance, I should tremble for the result of a second." So even there, a year after, the father of our Constitution was saying it would not be a good idea to hold another convention. So we've been blessed by God in the sense that it preserved in a way that we don't really deserve to be preserved from having such a constitutional convention called to consider amendments. Instead, the 27 amendments have all been done through the congressional route, two-thirds of both houses of Congress proposing an amendment, which then is sent to the states for ratification and three-quarters of the states ratifying. When we get to looking at the Bill of Rights and the subsequent amendments, we'll make some comments, especially about some of the illegalities that took place with some of the ratification, where some of them really weren't ratified by three-quarters, but they're treated as if they were and have been become de facto law, not that they were necessarily legally ratified. Nonetheless, the final element of the fifth article of the Constitution states that there's certain amendments that were prohibited. The first of which was slave trade was prohibited. Any amendment that would end the slave trade was prohibited before the year 1808. So they were giving a 30-year window in which slavery could continue. At the end of that 30-year window, and amendments to the Constitution were permissible that would end slave trade. Now, this was not because our founders, even those founders who were slaveholders themselves, it's not because they viewed slavery as a good thing, something that ought to be preserved. Rather, they were practical men and understood the difficulties of ending the slave business without great harm done actually to the slaves themselves. Consider James Madison, father of the Constitution. He had slaves, and he regretted having slaves. He didn't choose to have slaves in a direct sense. He married into it. And his wife's estate came with slaves. And so as a slaveholder, his conscience was torn. He wanted to see slavery ended, but he realized if he did so, he would do great harm to these people who would not have a job, not have a place to live, would have no means of supporting themselves. And so slavery needed to be phased out in steps, not all at once.
And so they were planning really on phasing out slavery, weren't they?
That's right. And they thought over 30 years would be a reasonable length of time to accomplish that.
All right, we're going to be back in just a moment with Pastor David Whitney here at the Radio Liberty. And, of course, Pastor Whitney is with the Institute of the Constitution. And when we get back, I will want you to learn how you can get in touch with his organization and learn how to put on programs in your community covering our amazing Constitution. Well, go ahead, David. Pick up the story there.
Well, so slave trade was given 30 years, and of course they expected, looking at the trend in their own lifetime and the trend in the past couple of decades, they saw slavery declining. That is, it was not as economically advantageous as it once was. The cotton industry, which is, and the tobacco industry, both of which employed the largest body of slaves, those, both of those industries were struggling, partly tobacco because it exhausted the soil so greatly and so on, but they saw slavery was naturally on its way out, and it was ultimately going to be phased out on its own without any great push from the federal government. What they couldn't have foreseen was an invention of a distant relative of mine, Eli Whitney, invented the cotton gin, and suddenly cotton became a very profitable commodity once again, and the cotton plantations began to flourish. They couldn't have foreseen this happening at that point in time in 1787, and that changed the whole timetable in which they thought slavery would be phased out in that respect. But you need to remember, our founders, even those who were slaveholders, had an understanding that this was not a perfect world, and that slavery was something that they wanted to see ended, and they believed a way in which it would be ended so the slaves themselves would be cared for and could be transitioned into having skills that were marketable outside the slave system would take place. And there were those who worked, Thomas Jefferson and others, who worked to accomplish that with their own slaves, trying to raise them up and give them skills as laborers that would have something that was valuable in the marketplace, so that when they left the plantation, they would have a skill by which to feed themselves and their families. So ending slave trade was prohibited before 1808. The other amendment prohibited was depriving any state of equal representation in the Senate without that state's consent. Of course, you remember the House of Representatives is designed to represent the population proportionately. That is, a larger state, such as California or Texas, has more representatives in the House of Representatives than the state of Maryland or the state of Alaska. So the state of Alaska, if I remember correctly, only has one person in the House of Representatives. But when it comes to the Senate, every state is represented equally, which gives the odd situation where Alaska has one member of the House of Representatives and two senators. So obviously, a state with a very thin population has a great deal more power in the Senate than their population would otherwise warrant them.
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stad, and right now I want Pastor Whitney to tell our listeners how they can get in touch with the Institute of the Constitution, perhaps begin putting on programs in their home, in their church, in their school, to begin to educate others about this wonderful document that separates America from all other nations. So, David, how can people get in touch with the Institute of the Constitution, and what, of course, does putting out a program really entail?
It's actually not very complicated, Dr. Stan. We've designed a turnkey method we call our host kit, because we don't say you're teaching the Constitution. Dr. Eidsmo in 12 lectures on DVD, half-hour lectures, does that. And David Barton with a few additional lectures accomplishes that. So it's a way in which any person, without necessarily any background in history or law or expertise in anything, is able to communicate these truths to their family, to their friends, to the fellow church members, which is where every church, I believe, ought to be teaching these principles, because what we're teaching in this course is the biblical view of law and government. Oddly, many Christians don't understand what the Bible has to say about law, what it has to say about government or economics. They should. It's part of the whole counsel of God that every church should be teaching. So a person can purchase a host kit and set up an institute on the Constitution in their home, gather people together there, or ideally in their church. And I always tell folks, you know, if your pastor struggles with the idea of having a course that teaches the Constitution in their church, just tell them this. You know, Jesus commanded us to be citizens and to fulfill our citizenship when he said, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and render to God the things that are God's. Ask him, what is Caesar in America? Is it the president? Well, sometimes he thinks he is. Or is it the Congress? Well, they want to be Caesar. Is it the Supreme Court? They often act like they're Caesar, but they are not. What is Caesar in America is this Constitution and the Declaration and the Bill of Rights. These are the supreme law of the land. therefore, for a citizen to obey the command of Jesus, to render to Caesar the things that are Caesar, in America, that means they must, to be a Christian citizen, they must know the Declaration, what its original intent is. They must know the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. So you could explain to a pastor or anyone else in the church that this is fulfilling and obeying the commands of Christ, which basically that's the mission of every church if it's following the Bible. That is to disciple all nations, and Jesus told us what it meant to disciple all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to observe, that is to obey, everything I commanded you. That's what Jesus told his disciples, and that is the commission he gave to his church. So every church, if they're going to fulfill the commission, the great commission that Christ gave them, they must teach and make disciples of their people so that their people can obey the commandment of Jesus to render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. That's what this course does. And it's very simple for anyone to put on. And we have a toll-free number. People can call and order a host kit by that means. And our toll-free number is 866-730-9796. Let me give that again. Our toll-free number is 866-730-9796. Or if they want to go to our website, we just had a total revamp of our website. It's beautiful. It's really some nice features to it. Our website, which has the web store on it, is iotconline.com. That's iotconline.com. And if you go to our web store on that website, then you can order a host kit, and there's many other excellent materials, books that will help you understand your role as a Christian citizen. And we are just very encouraged by what's happening across America. As I was talking with somebody in Mississippi this month who's planning this fall to launch a course in their town in Biloxi, and other places around the country are preparing this fall to be hosting a class. 47 states that we know of have classes that are being hosted or have been hosted recently, and millions of Americans is what we envision are going to be trained in what our founders said was essential to preserve our constitutional republic.
And, Christian, are the courses available in both DVD and VHS?
That's right, both DVD as well as VHS. So you have to make a special request for VHS, but that is also available because we know that many people do not yet have a DVD player. Yes.
Okay, fine. Well, I want to attest to the genius of this whole program. It means that the average individual, without any real training in the Constitution, can put on a course to train others, and then, of course, they even tell you what the questions and answers, and if you don't know the answer to a question that's asked, you can always get hold of the Institute, and they'll get you the answer. But it is wonderful when people suddenly begin to realize this amazing document that we have and the fact that it was really based upon biblical principles. In other words, certainly the founding fathers did not want a state religion because every one of the states had their own religion. They didn't want had to be a Protestant, or you had to be a Catholic, or you had to be a Congregationalist or a Quaker serve in the federal government. But it was acknowledged that the states would require you, if you were going to represent your state, to many times to have a religion, and certainly to believe in God and believe eternal punishment. In fact, many of the states actually required that you, make a belief in the Trinity before you could actually represent their state at the national level. So there was the idea that there was a wall of separation between church and state is just totally absurd. And any of you would like to read my latest newsletter, it was the July newsletter, Are We a Christian Nation? I would be glad to send you a copy free of charge. If you call us at 1-800-544-8927, how can you argue that we are a Christian nation? Well, first of all, you have to understand what you're talking about when you say we're a Christian nation. Nobody ever defines the term, but that's another subject for another evening. Let's get back to Pastor David Whitney, because it's so important that you understand what the Constitution says, because this is the very bulwark of our freedom. Go ahead.
That's right. So stepping into Article 6, Article 6 deals with several different issues, the first of which is that our founders agreed that the debts and the agreements entered into before the Constitution was ratified would be recognized as valid. Now, we need to understand that this is an unusual move. Most often when new forms of government came along, people repudiated the former debt. Said, we're not going to pay that. Forget it. And we're not going to honor any former commitments we made. But our founders, because of God's word, based upon God's principles, said, as a Christian republic, we must honor those things that we have entered into contractually. We cannot default on our debts and just blow those people off. They understood what the psalmist said in Psalm 15, Lord, who may abide in your tabernacle, who may dwell in your holy hill? One of the qualifications that's listed there in verse 4 is that the person who swears to his own hurt and does not change, that is a person who makes a vow, and then they discover after they made it, wow, hey, wait a minute, this cost me much more than I intended. There were things I didn't expect when I made this promise, and I'm having a hard time fulfilling this promise. The psalmist says, the person who abides in the tabernacle of the Lord is a person who, when they make a vow, they keep that vow even when it hurts them. And so our founders did not repudiate the debts that had been entered into. And this actually was a great boon to our nation because it helped foreign governments have confidence in the fledgling U.S. government. It helped also restore national unity because much of the national debt was owed to citizens here. So people were holding bonds of the United States. If the United States repudiated those bonds, they'd be out all that money. And so this actually was not only it was obedience to God's word, but it was also, as whenever we obey God's word, a very wise and honorable thing to do. Next, we come to the Supremacy Clause. Again, I've spoken of this earlier. This is one of the most important statements in the Constitution. The supreme law of the land is the United States Constitution. That means any law made that violates the Constitution, things like the Patriot Act. When we get to looking at the Fourth Amendment, we'll see how blatantly the Patriot Act violates the Fourth Amendment. Anything that violates the Fourth Amendment, any part of the Constitution, the amendments or the articles, is invalid because otherwise you would say the Patriot Act is the supreme law of the land. No, it's not. It is the Constitution that's the supreme law of the land. And federal laws made under the authority thereof of the Constitution are valid. That is, if a federal law is made that's a violation of the Constitution, it's not valid, it's not law at all. Call it what you want, but really, it's just paper that needs to be put in the shredder. It's not law at all. That's what the Patriot Act is. It should be put in the shredder. It should not be followed by any law enforcement officer who takes an oath, which all of them do, an oath to uphold the Constitution. Furthermore, this Supremacy Clause says that treaties made under the authority of the United States are also supreme. Now, it's very important to see that there's a difference here in the wording. Federal laws made under the authority of the Constitution versus treaties made under the authority of the United States. The difference between those two is because treaties had been entered into prior to the ratification of the Constitution. And our framers were saying, just as with debts, that when they entered a treaty, they intended to honor the treaties made before the Constitution was adopted. However, any treaty that violates the Constitution is in itself a false treaty. In other words, for example, the United Nations supposed treaty. Really, I agree with Herb Titus, who says it's a charter of another constitution, a international constitution and all that, and claims supremacy over the U.S. Constitution. Therefore, it's invalid. But any treaty that is in violation of the Constitution cannot legally be entered into by the United States. Even if the Senate passes it and says, oh, yeah, we approve it, and the President, that doesn't make it legal because otherwise you would say there's another way of amending the Constitution, and the way of amending the Constitution is just form a treaty with another nation. And that is illegitimate. You cannot do that, or else the Constitution's not the supreme law of the land. The treaties are the supreme law of the land. So Constitution, federal laws, and treaties take precedence over state laws and state constitutions. Actually, state judges take an oath to be bound to the United States Constitution, its federal laws and treaties. That they cannot, in their judicial decisions and opinions, violate this Constitution. And then finally, the oath of office is required for all federal as well as all state judges, legislators, officers, governors, etc. Everyone must take an oath to support the Constitution. As you mentioned already, It says here that no religious test for federal office is required, but remember what they're doing. They're taking an oath. What is an oath? An oath is a solemn vow made before Almighty God on the threat that your soul will go to hell if you violate this vow, that you're promising before God to do certain things. Now, wait a minute. Isn't that a religious test? Yes. Can an atheist take an oath? No. They can't take an oath because they don't believe in this God that they're taking this oath to. You know, can a Muslim take an oath to the Christian God? No, they cannot. So, although it says no religious test, as you pointed out earlier, that simply means that no denominational doctrinal standard of a Christian denomination was going to be used as a measure for whether someone could take federal office. That decision was to happen at the state level. As you rightly said, many states had very strict and very Christian doctrinal requirements that said if a person doesn't believe in eternal punishment of hell, eternal rewards of heaven, they cannot hold office. Not only in this state, they can't even be, run for office at the federal level. So the states were the gatekeepers, religiously speaking, for who would be permitted to run for federal office and who would not be permitted to run for federal office. It wasn't that federal office holders could be atheists. No, not at all. It's that the decisions about doctrinally what they must hold to was a decision to be made on the state level, not on the federal level. Again, the states were sovereign entities in and of themselves that created the federal government. And so the Constitution was structured such that it would not violate the sovereignty of the individual states in creating this constitutional structure of our constitutional republic. So the framers felt those questions of religious tests and oaths were best left to the state governments and not to the federal government. Now, this is an entirely different view than what we have today. We have an anti-Christian approach to government that says there is no religion to be spoken of, no one's to bring up the Christian faith or Christian doctrine, and it's not to have any effect on anything that takes place in the federal government. Well, that's absolutely ludicrous. As you read what our founders said very, very clearly in statements all over the place, they talked about the Christian principles and the biblical principles and the laws of nature and nature's God, which are contained in the Bible. Those things were essential, and they were what was to guide legislators as they crafted pieces of legislation. They were to guide presidents as presidents made executive decisions and enforced the law, and they were to guide judges as judges interpreted and applied the law in specific cases. I was just reading recently here about one of the amazing things, Ulysses S. Grant. I don't admire him as a president in many, many respects, but he did something that was very typical of presidents in that day. He assigned a portion of the United States to a particular Protestant denomination for the evangelization of the heathen, which in that day meant the Native American Indians. And basically, he gave a portion of the United States to this particular Christian denomination to evangelize the Indians there, and another portion to another. So here was the President of the United States making decisions regarding evangelism and missions. Just many people today say, what? That could never happen in America. Oh, it did. Look at your history books. You will see that that Christianity was never divorced from our form of government until the beginning of the 20th century, when wicked men began to plot and plan. Well, they had actually been plotting and planning ever since the War for Independence was won, plotting to destroy this Christian republic that was being established. But they didn't actually gain steam, a great deal of steam, until the beginning of the 20th century. And then they got powerful presidents in who began to alter our form of government, unconstitutionally, by the way, and do things that were destructive of this form of government. So if we understand the history, and that's the hard thing to get through to people, Dr. Stan, because so much of the propaganda and the lies have been told to people again and again and again and again, and they believe these lies. They think, well, that's what it was. Well, you need to check it out for yourself, and that's why our course, Institute on the Constitution, is designed to do, to take you back to the original sources, to see what our founders said, to look at their quotations, that you can go back and see their writings, you can go back and see their decisions, and recognize that these men were Christians. And these men established a Christian constitutional republic, and they said the only way you'll preserve this republic is if you elect to office godly Christian men, men who understand the biblical principles of law and government, and who are committed to abiding by those principles as they rule and lead our nation.
And, of course, as the Supreme Court opens every session, when the choir comes in and says, God save the United States and this honorable court. Right above where the judges sit, there is a replica of the Ten Commandments. They're also on the door of the Supreme Court, and yet those wicked men say, oh, there's a wall of separation between church and state. They know it isn't true. They just don't want you to realize the truth. Well, David, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up this evening's program.
Well, if anyone still doubts that the Constitution is Christian-based, with the oath in Article 6 being very clearly a Christian oath that is being taken by every federal office holder and required of every state judge and legislature, you just have to turn to Article 7. We won't be able to look at all the details here, but specifically, let me examine the final phrase, which is called the subscription clause. That is, just above where all the signers signed it, it says, in the year of our Lord, 1787. In other words, they dated the signing of this document from 1,787 years after who? The Lord Jesus Christ. And they didn't say the Lord. They could have said the Lord just to make a statement, okay, we're in AD and not BC. But they didn't say the Lord Jesus Christ. They said our Lord Jesus Christ. And if you recall what we talked about of the philosophy, the worldview of law and government of our founders, they had a covenantal understanding of human government. That human governments are a covenant entered into by we the people with our civil government and we the people with our Lord Jesus Christ and our civil government with our Lord Jesus Christ. How do we know this? That's why every person taking a position of power must take an oath. Who do they take that oath to? The Lord Jesus Christ. Every person casting their vote, when you as a citizen function, you should be doing so in light of your covenant with our Lord Jesus Christ. So that you are putting people into office who are going to honor the Lord Jesus Christ and fulfill their oath to the Lord Jesus Christ, and you, the citizen, are going to keep a careful eye upon them to be sure that they fulfill that covenant that they have entered into. Unlike the French Revolutionists, which just a few years later brought a horrific bloodbath, to that land, they eliminated the calendar. They said, year zero is the year that we begin our French Revolution, and they threw out the calendar and throughout the week, the seven-day week even, and attempted a 10-day week, which was idiocy, and they finally had to come back to a seven-day week. But so it's not that our founders were doing something that was standard that everybody did. No, the French Revolution did very differently. Our founders were saying, we are entering a covenant by this Constitution with our Lord Jesus Christ because he is the sovereign ruler of the universe. It is his supreme law that we are seeking to follow, and therefore everything in his supreme law, the laws of nature and nature's God, is binding upon us as we enter this covenant.
We're out of time, David. Thank you so very much. We'll look forward to having you back with us again next month. Our guest has been Pastor David Whitney.
God bless you, Dr. Stan. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thank you so much, David. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I think what's so important is for you to understand that the founding fathers of this country wanted the individual to be ruled by God. That is where the authority was to come from. We were to be ruled by God. The power of the central government was to be limited so that men could be free. Free men are ruled by God. Freedom is not the ability to do whatever you want to do, as the satanists and the atheists would have you believe. Freedom is the ability to do what you should do according to God's rules. That is where the true freedom comes from, because none of us, of course, has the ability to do what is right simply on our own. If we look to our own desires, if we accept the philosophy of Aleister Crowley, do what thou wilt, being the whole of the law, why, of course, you end up with a moral and social anarchy, and tragically, that is what they're teaching our children in school today. because our schools have been taken over by Luciferian forces, and there really are Luciferian forces in America. For those of you who doubt that, you need to get certainly my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. You need to get the videos, They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll, the new video by Joe Schimmel, The Da Vinci Con, Hollywood's Attack on America. That's The Da Vinci Con, Hollywood's Attack on America. The Secret Mystery of America's Beginnings. That's The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginnings. Megiddo 1, Megiddo 2, they're all by our good friend Chris Petto, who incidentally will be one of our speakers at the conference we're going to be putting on the 29th of October. I hope many of you are beginning to make preparations to come to the conference on the 29th of October. It's going to be here in the Monterey Bay area, and we're lining up our speakers. We're going to have great speakers, and we want everybody to come. You'll learn a lot, and you'll get a chance to, of course, meet the people who feel as you do. So you're going to have to start calling in. We want reservations ahead of time. It's a Sunday, but it was the only day we could get that meeting hall. That's the 29th of October. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, and we'll get the directions and hope to see you there. And then, of course, we hope that many of you will certainly go to our website of RadioLiberty.com, look at the various items that we carry. They do help us subsidize what we're doing. As you know, we carry the Berkey, Big Berkey and Berkey Light, and they're poisoning you and your children with fluoride. They know exactly what they're doing. They just don't want you to know, because people who drink fluoridated water become less aggressive. And it's certainly the child, it'll knock 10 points off their IQ. You don't have any geniuses in areas where they have fluoridated water. You have a lot of people, about three times the number of people with borderline intelligence. IQ's down around 70. These studies that have been done in China, it takes about 10 points off your IQ. Why would anybody want to hurt a child? Because we're dealing with evil people. Why would they give them mercury, knowing full well that it's going to damage their brains? Because, of course, they are wicked and evil people. If you've not seen the new video we have by Dr. Ayub, it's the talk he gave last year about, of course, this effort to force women now in the first trimester of pregnancy to take an influenza shot, which is loaded with mercury, that will destroy her child's, unborn child's, brain if it doesn't cause abortion. And of course, what it does, it affects the DNA so that at least in animals, future generations cannot reproduce. That is why we are giving all these vaccinations all throughout the world to children in third world countries. We're giving them free childhood vaccines. Aren't we nice to give them those vaccines loaded with mercury? They've taken it out of the childhood vaccinations in America, but we're giving them to children throughout the world. Why would anybody do that? Knowing full well it's going to lower their intellect, increase the incidence of autism, poison their reproduction, and increase the incidence of cancer. And, well, maybe that's exactly what they want. Aren't there too many people in the world? If you have not yet seen my talk on the planned population reduction, it's available from Radio Liberty. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, RadioLiberty.com. And please pray for America. Pray for revival. But please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so, well, we'll be back here in just a few moments for the next hour here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Arthur Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and, well, we're going to ask you to hold your calls unless we specifically ask for them after the half hour, because our guest this evening is one of my favorites. It's Bob Chapman of the International Forecaster, and we're going to be talking about what's happening in the economy. Now, I don't know how many of you caught a speech that was given by the head of the Fed, the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, Ben Bernanke. Dr. Bernanke gave a talk last Friday in which he talked about the benefits of globalism and how the American policy of globalism was helping to raise the living standards of people throughout the world. And it was very specifically and praiseworthy of what was going on, and said we had to continue with our program of globalism because it was helping people throughout the rest of the world so much. And there was certainly drives and efforts within America to cut back on globalism. We couldn't allow that to happen. And as I read all of his remarks, you know, there was one thing that really stood out in my mind. He didn't once mention what was good for America. All he did was talk about what was good for the people throughout the rest of the world, and that is what the policies of the Fed were really all about. Well, wait a minute. I thought the Federal Reserve System was supposed to protect the American dollar. It certainly hasn't been doing a very good job. Is it possible that the purpose of our central bank has nothing to do with financial stability in America, but is part of this scheme for a new world order, and a new world religion, and a new world monetary system? And with that as an opening, Bob Chapman, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, very nice to be here again, and you always give me all the easy questions.
All right, fine. What did you think about that speech of Bernanke's? Did you pick up on that?
Yeah, it was as you said it was. What they're into right now is that and I could quote the president from IBM a few months ago, and it was in the Forecaster, and he said, I think we should move all of our facilities out of the United States because they are going to put tariffs on. And this is the kind of herd thinking that you get with all groups. And what he forgot was that if they move out and they want to ship in export to the United States, they're going to have to pay those duties whether they're on services or on hardware.
But, Bob, I don't think that we're going to. I mean, we should put on tariffs. We should try to protect our own industry. We should try to be chauvinistic. We should try to protect the living standards of the average American, because that's where our first loyalty should be, because, of course, you don't help the poor by destroying the rich. But, of course, that is the policy. Of course, what the elitists want is not to redistribute their wealth. It is to redistribute the wealth of the middle class of the United States of America.
Well, you're right about that, but the point I'm trying to make is that the head of IBM said this is going to happen. So they fully expect it. And all of the other internationalists are being told the same thing, that this is what it's going to come down to. And Bernanke, of course, is singing the praises so that maybe hopefully that won't happen. And as you say, the Fed represents the elitist multi-rich, not us.
Hold on, we'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. All right, Bob, go ahead, pick up the story from there.
And I think they're in a quandary because they didn't think this thing all the way to the end. And the end is what's happening is either by design, the American economies, along with Western Europe, are going to collapse. And they're going to collapse because the social, political, and cultural structure is going down, and it's caused by free trade and globalization, because first, all the inexpensive jobs, the one that pays the lowest wages, they were moved to the third world with offshoring, and then that was followed by outsourcing as we get up the line in jobs and the quality of jobs. And so Europe is in the same spot that we are, only I think they've got much, well, certainly as bad a problem as the United States. And this process is now getting to the point where even if they wanted to stop it, they couldn't. And so they will inflate through monetization, through the Fed, and through other central banks. I might add here that most people aren't aware of it because most of you people don't subscribe to the International Forecaster, and most of you don't know that the Federal Reserve has been increasing money and credit, which used to be called M3, but they did away with M3 because they don't want you to know what's going on. And the International Forecaster is the only publication that I own, know of, that estimates what M3 is right now. And it's the same way it was 4 and 6 months ago. And the same thing is going on in Europe. They have this recovery going on in Europe. Why? No one ever talks about it. The recovery is based upon the expansion of money and credit, which right now is about 9.5-10%. Well, in the United States, it's probably 11-12%. And so that's why the economies keep on going on, and they don't know anything else to do until they want to pull the plug, if they want to. And that's hard to tell because everything in the Middle East that they have planned has gone haywire. The Taliban's back in Afghanistan, and all sorts of terrible things are happening there in spite of the fact they're making all kinds of money in the opium crop. And then, next, we have Iraq where you've got a civil war. Over 100 people were killed today. And our troops are caught in between. And Israel went into...
Hold that thought for just a moment here.
Sure.
We'll be right back with Bob. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Bob Chapman, and he's basically saying that things aren't going very well for the internationalists. That, you know, things are bad in Afghanistan. The Taliban are coming back. The opium crop is booming. Of course, I believe that we want the opium crop booming. We could stop the opium trade anytime we want to. It's so difficult for the average American to believe that what our leaders keep talking about of war on drugs, they mean exactly the opposite. The war on drugs is designed to increase the incidence of drug use. The war on cancer is designed to increase the incidence of cancer. And because if it wasn't, why do we have more cancer? Why do we have more drugs? The war on terrorism is designed to increase terrorism. If it didn't, why do we have more terrorism than we ever had before? And more people willing to just give up their lives simply to kill other people by wearing suicide bombers? All of these so-called wars, you know, that the government is launching, a war on disease, you know, all of these, a war on crime, and what do we have? We have more crime and more disease than ever before. So pick up the story there, Bob.
Well, all of their plans in the Middle East have just gone haywire. I was speaking about Lebanon, and the Israeli forces didn't have food and water and proper equipment, and on and on and on. And now there's a big investigation coming in Israel as to why all that happened. And I have read reports that it was a false operation and it was deliberate as Israel prepares an even bigger battle against Syria and Iran. But, you know, who knows? I don't know if I can be that sophisticated about it at this point in time. So, discounting that, all the things that they have done in the Middle East have just not worked. And now, on the other hand, we step back and we talk about the financial and economic situation in Western Europe and North America, Mexico, in China and Japan, and these economies are all going to be under tremendous pressure. And they only could put that pressure off so long by increasing the money supply because of the U.S. debt. And if they continue to do that and have higher inflation, people are not going to want to buy U.S. Treasury bills, and they have to buy $3 billion a day worth in order to keep the United States from slipping into bankruptcy, and for the U.S. dollar, which is a reserve currency of the world, to slide ever further against other currencies and gold and silver. And so I think they've got a real problem. And the tip-off was about 3 months ago when Brzezinski said, I could have never imagined that anybody could make such a mess out of the Middle East. And he was the guy that laid down the plans in the early 80s when I was writing about it and telling people this is where they're headed and this is what they're going to do. And he's pulling his hair out, what's left of it. And he's saying, these people have just made a terrible mess of everything. And it set the plans for world government back 5 years. Well, I think it's going to be a lot more than 5 years. So here, they can't complete their program in the Middle East. The amount of money it's costing to do this is staggering. It'll be over $1 trillion easy. And that's if they don't go into Iran and Syria. If they do, you can quadruple it. And at the same time, the economy in the Western world is headed down a great dark hole. And they can't stop that. They can delay it, but they can't stop it. And so I think the conspiracies, best plans have come asunder. And I think they're in serious trouble.
Well, I certainly hope you're right. I see that things are not doing very well economically. In Germany, they're having some real problems. Here in the United States, of course, the housing market is beginning to crumble. Certainly, they're continuing to pump out massive amounts of money in the form of M3, and that's not necessarily currency in circulation as much as making the availability of credit and money available to try to keep the economy going. But there's just no way you can do that when you've destroyed the industrial base of the country. That's what most people don't understand. That and the increased price of oil has certainly meant that people have less money to spend buying things. They're giving it all to Exxon and Shell, and the big oil is certainly taking in, siphoning off so much of the money that ordinarily people would be spending. And of course, people aren't spending the money. Then, of course, other people don't have jobs working in places where ordinarily they would have gone, for lunch or dinner or where they do their shopping. So I think that right now we're sort of at the top, aren't we? We haven't really begun to contract too much, or have we?
Well, I think we're at the top of where the economies can go. They're all headed down. The only exception is I think Europe will last a little bit longer if they continue to do what they're doing. You have to remember that when they put money and credit into the system, and that's far more important than the interest rates, when they put it into the system, it buoys the system, you get inflation, but things continue to be okay economically. The problem is that you only can do that so long, and you start pushing on a string. People say, well, I don't want to borrow any more money, whether it's a company or an individual. And so what happens next is you start to get weakness. And, of course, in the case of the United States, the United Kingdom, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, what they've done is they created another bubble after the stock market bubble, in which people lost approximately $4 trillion, excuse me, $7 trillion. And we're faced with a housing correction, which in some hot areas, you'll see a 35% drop, and in other hot areas, you'll see 40 to 50%.
Well, but that hasn't started yet, has it?
Oh, sure it has. It started a year ago, June. The real numbers started to show up in the inventory last September, and if you look at the sales during this summer, which is the highest season of the year for sales, you'll notice that sales of existing as well as new homes is off. As I told you the other day, this industry is high, inventory is higher than it's been in the 40 years that I've been in business. And
well,
so,
yeah, but the prices have not yet begun.
Well, there's a reason for that.
Not yet.
And I'll tell you why. What's happening is that people, in order to sell their homes, are holding their price, but they're giving incentives. These incentives can be as much as, by builders and individuals, as much as $50,000, $60,000 in a house. Usually it's anywhere between 3% and 8%, depending upon the area and the desirability and the price. Now, what's happened over the last couple of weeks is that Fannie Mae has said, look, we want to know what the incentives are that are being given to hold the price at this level. And now they're telling the lenders, who they buy the mortgages from, no, you have to tell us that information. And now the lenders are being told to tighten up. So what does that mean? It means the incentives are going to be gone, and they're going to have to reflect it in the price. And if you did it right now, you'd have most real estate in hot areas down 10% at least.
Okay.
So I see another 5% before the end of the year, 15% next year, and the following year another 15% depending upon what area you're in. If you live in Indianapolis, which didn't appreciate at all, your house isn't going anywhere. It's probably going to stay where it was. I saw Lou Dobbs' program on CNN today. I saw people lined up in a window in the city of Chicago inside a building, and they were bidding on foreclosed real estate, which is up 60% in Chicago, 42% in Detroit, and 41% in Los Angeles. So it's beginning, and next year is going to be bad. The following year will be worse. I mean, this is not going to go away. And I got to say another thing. You were talking about Mr. Bernanke. At the Williams Hole Symposium, one of the speakers was a fellow named Bean. And Bean is the chief economist for the Bank of England. And he told the assembled pointy-headed people there that the U.S. should not be zeroing in on core inflation because it's a misnomer. We in Europe are zeroing in on entire inflation, and that would include food, which is always with us, whether it's volatile or not, and the energy prices, which they say is a long-term upward trend. And you people, by telling your public in America that core inflation is 2.5%, when in fact year-to-date real inflation is 4.5%, and year-to-date this year it's 4.1%. And so you should stop doing that. And they're right.
All right. Of course, you feel the real inflation is really even probably twice that, don't you?
I think it's close to 11% right now.
And, of course, what that means is the value of your savings, the value of your pension plan, all of those things are just plummeting at 10 to 11% a year. And so what they're doing, of course, is stealing the wealth of the American people. And that's exactly what certainly Alan Greenspan said in his classic edit essay back in 1966. He said the attack on gold is because the welfare state doesn't want the people to have any means to protect their wealth. And, you know, if there was another means of protecting your wealth, why, they would attack that as well. Taking us off the gold standard is a conscious effort to deprive the people of having any means of protecting their wealth. And I think that's what it's really all about. And the average individual isn't going to realize what's happened until it's too late. Would you agree or disagree?
I agree. And when we come back, there's something I want to discuss about freedom.
All right, fine. We're going to be back here in just a moment. Our special guest this evening is Bob Chapman, the international forecaster, certainly one of my favorite guests, and I hope he's yours as well. Be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Go ahead, Bob.
There was a case recently where a Nebraska state trooper stopped an automobile and a person named Gomez was the driver. And he searched the vehicle. It was a rental car. And he found $124,000 in the trunk. And he asked Mr. Gomez why was he had all that money. And he said, I had gone with this money, which is part of money of a number of people, to bid on a refrigerator truck in, I guess it was Chicago. And I was unsuccessful in bidding, so I'm going home. And the cop says, well, I don't believe you. So they brought him in, and they brought the money in, and they decided that Mr. Gomez had done nothing wrong. And so they released him. He had no record or anything. But they kept the money. So Mr. Gomez went to court, and the court said, if you have that kind of money, you must be a drug dealer. So the government, the state, whatever it is, keeps the money. They went to appeals court. Appeals court said the same thing. Now, the justification for this, and you're going to see more of this, is the court said that any large amount of money, now, they didn't say how much. Now, large might be $2,000 or it might be $22,000. Since then, the guideline has been given up by Gonzalez, as the Attorney General of the United States, to the police association, is that anything $10,000 or over. But it's in any currency, including gold and silver bullion. And this is part of Patriot Act number 2. And so they're going to try to use this excuse to confiscate people's assets. Now, they're talking now about automobiles, trains, buses, boats, steamships, whatever it is, airplanes that people convey upon, and that would be brought in. But they'll expand it, and they'll say, anybody that has this, we want it. And so it's an outright looting of the American public. And this has been in the works for about 2.5 years. One of the things I also did within that act is that it allows the United States government via their tax, reciprocal tax treaties with other governments to access the accounts of Americans who they say have in some way broken the law. And, of course, if they don't have anything on you, they say, oh, he's a money launderer. And then they access your foreign accounts if you have them, even if they're perfectly legitimate. And it is legitimate to have an account in Toronto or Mexico City or whatever, as long as you have declared it to the United States government. And they also can go into and confiscate the contents of a safe deposit box that you have outside of the United States. So this is where this is headed. And so what we have now is police as collection agents. And I guess the money goes to the feds, and the feds kick back whatever they kick back, 20, 30, 40%. It's just like the drug deals. They catch somebody doing peddling drugs. They confiscate everything they have. They sell it off.
Hold up. I will be right back here. But... Dr. Stan and Bob is simply telling us that they're increasingly taking people's money. You have any sum of money? We're talking about Mr. Gonzalez, who had a good deal of money. He'd gotten from a number of people to buy a truck. He'd borrowed the money. Anyway, it was $124,000, and they just took the money and kept it. And increasingly, the government is going into foreign bank accounts and foreign safety deposit boxes and doing everything they can to steal people's money. And they say, well, you might be a terrorist, and so we're going to take everything you have. What sort of insanity is that, and where is the outcry from the American people? Well, most people aren't upset, Dill. It's their bank account that gets raided by the government. Could they do this? Yes, they can. It's all in the nature of fighting the wicked Osama bin Laden, who's hiding over there in a cave in Pakistan and is going to get us all if we don't, of course, give all power to the all-powerful government.
Well, the problem with that is that Osama bin Laden was hired, trained, and worked for the Central Intelligence Agency in MI6. So, fat chance we're ever going to catch him. But getting back to what I was talking about, the usurpation of our rights, I think what's going to happen in this next election, which is something they hadn't planned on, they being the elitists, and that is that I think, and I'm guessing, but it's a qualified guess, 55 to 60% of the incumbents are going to be defeated. And I think the Republicans are going to lose one or both houses. And when that happens, I can assure you, there will be war, and there will be a draft, and there will be an excuse not to have elections in 2008, so there's a meatball, and the White House can continue to be essentially dictator. And that's where we're headed with this thing. And, you know, even within this Patriot Act, too, and they haven't really pushed it yet, is anybody who says anything derogatory about the government can be picked up and detained indefinitely without charges. And so now you know why I don't live in the United States.
Well, anyway, I think it's so important that people understand that freedom is not free, or that this whole war on terrorism is as phony as a $3 bill, because I certainly agree. If you study the background of Osama bin Laden and read the books that were written before 9/11, and since then almost everything has been censored, but you'll find out that the Al-Qaeda was financed by the CIA, the Taliban were financed by the CIA, and so was the wicked Osama bin Laden. In fact, they even allowed al-Zawahiri, his right-hand man, to come to the United States in 1995 to collect money and purchase military equipment and other electronic equipment to be used by al-Qaeda. Why would you let a man who's wanted for murder in Egypt come to the United States and travel around freely here? I mean, well, because, of course, he and certainly and bin Laden are the ideal enemies. You have to have an enemy to rally the people against, and that's what it's all about. Go ahead, Bob.
Well, they're playing that terrorism card, and they'll play it out to the very end as the American economy and the world economy collapses. And when that happens, people are going to say, oh, my goodness gracious, I've never had a bad day in my life. And so how am I going to feed my kids? I certainly can't pay my mortgage payment because I don't work anymore. What am I to do? And the government going to say, well, we'll let you continue to live in that house there because we own it now because you defaulted on it. And we have a terrific job. They live in Chicago. And we have a terrific job for you in Los Angeles picking up papers on the street. And we're going to send your wife to Milwaukee because we have a typist job there for her, and we'll put your kids in our government school, and we'll take very good care of them. And, you know, this is the old regional government, and that's what they're going to do. And they have all of this lined up, and I can promise you they're going to try to execute it. The only saving grace here is the election, if we can blow them all out of office, so to speak, and the fact that they've made such a mess out of the Middle East. They may not be able to, even if they want to, go into Iran and Syria. So only time will tell. It's a lot of guesswork, but on my and your part, it's educated guesswork because we've been both doing this for almost 50 years. And I think we've got a pretty good handle on what can happen. And this is where we're headed.
Well, I agree with you totally, Bob, and I just hope and pray that, of course, we do not get involved with the war of Iran, but it should be obvious that the people who control the media, which is, of course, the Council on Foreign Relations, establishment, want an excuse to go to war with Iran. Because I think they want to precipitate World War III, which they know will have devastating effect here on the United States of America. There are terrorist cells, Hezbollah, Hamas, terrorist cells all across America. The government knows about it. The government refuses to do anything about it, and you have to ask yourself why. Is there another agenda? Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Bob Chapman for the International Forecaster. We're already talking about what is happening economically to our nation, and certainly the employment rate is certainly not that good. They make up statistics all the time to tell you about all the new jobs that they're creating. But you were pointing out that in about two or three months it created something like, they said that they'd created 39,000 jobs? Is that about
right? That's correct. And in the last 5 months, our economy has actually lost jobs. And they do that through a device called the birth-death ratio. It's just another canard. It's a phony baloney deal that they call something like that by that name, and it's supposed to mean something. And they're supposed to have this magical formula that guesses how many jobs were created by small business and medium-sized business in the United States, because supposedly they can't get that information, which is untrue. And so they holy baloney the figures every month. They do the same kind of thing with the CPI, and the PPI, and the Producer Price Index, and the Consumer Price Index. And as we discussed earlier, they're much higher than what they double what they say they are or more. And based upon that, you've got to say to yourself, well, how do you make an intelligent decision? When I get research, if they're using government statistics as a basis, I just pitched the whole piece of research because it's no good, because the basic premise that they're working with is unfound. And so you've got to come up with your own basic figures. You've got to figure out what they're doing and how they're doing it so that you can better understand. I'll give an example. Bob Toll, who owns with his brother, the Toll Brothers Builders, one of the largest in the United States, and they build upper-end homes. And he, as we discussed earlier in the program, said, we've got this big inventory, the biggest in 40 years. And we've got high unemployment, high employment, and everything seems to be going hunky-dory. And why is this happening? Well, Mr. Toll, the reason it's happening is that all the figures you're being given are lies. And so they're hurting people in business now by having people make decisions based upon false figures. And the builders within the construction industry are really going to get hurt.
We'll be right back, Bob.
Sure.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Bob was just saying that the builders and the construction industry are going to get really badly hurt because, of course, they are determining their economic decisions based upon phony figures being put out by the government aimed at trying to convince them the economy isn't so bad, we've got full employment, but, of course, it really isn't true. Well, let's before we go on, Bob, I'd like you to tell our listeners how they can get in touch with you and get a copy of the International Forecaster and perhaps even subscribe if they'd like.
Well, you can get a free introductory copy by calling toll-free, and that number is 800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. If you'd like to visit our site, that address is theinternationalforecaster.com. The International, Forecaster.
All right, very good. All right, well, I certainly commend your publication. I look forward to it every week, and certainly if I don't get it, I feel very, very frustrated. So anyway,
well, if you don't get it, just email me and we'll send it to you.
All right.
Sometimes strange things happen out there in Athens, and we are publishing by email now twice a week on Wednesdays and Saturdays, And, of course, we have a hard copy that goes out twice a month as well.
Well, it's an excellent publication. It will give you a tremendous insight into what's going on. And one of the points that Bob makes, and I think it's so important, is that we can anticipate the economy will not collapse until perhaps about a year or so after they begin to cutting back on the M3. In other words, the ready availability of credit and money out there in the market, and probably the only place you're really going to see what the Fed is really doing, because they're going to lie to you in the newspapers, is by reading the International Forecaster. Well, they're certainly playing games with gold and silver, aren't they?
They are, and actually they're playing games with everything. But gold, in particular gold, because it's fully a monetary metal, even though it's used for jewelry. You hear this canard that jewelry is 75% of gold uses, but what they don't tell you is about 80% of that is for 23-carat bangles that people buy in India and the Middle East and in China for adornment occasionally, but for a rainy day. And they like to buy it that way rather than buy bullion or coins, although they're starting to buy coins. And so what's happened to the plans of the elitists as far as the suppression of gold is concerned is that free trade and globalization have given people in the Middle East and all throughout Asia money to be able to buy extra things. And almost all those cultures are historically buyers of gold. So the physical offtake in the gold market has been tremendous. And the faster the central bank sold the gold, the faster they bought it.
Well, of course,
and it's still going on.
Are the central banks really selling the gold, or are they selling it to one another?
Well, if you have large amounts of gold, they're selling it to one another. Or a central bank will sell it to a large individual banker, such as the Rothschilds or the royal family in England or the Rockefellers or whatever. And these are the people who buy the large amounts. And
I mean, when you're selling 1,500 tons of gold, I mean, most of us just are not in a position to go out and buy that.
Well, 70% of it, it may be as much as 80, goes out in the form of jewelry, to mostly to the third world. And so, and it's 150-ton shortfall. And what that means is that people are consuming 150 tons or more a year than is produced. And, of course, all of the gold that's ever been mined is above ground is still around. But it's dispersed much more widely and has been over the past, say, 10 years. And so free trade and globalization has had unintended consequences for the central bankers. But I believe that they're close to being out of gold. And I think they temporarily try to suppress prices by using derivatives and also by shorting gold in the marketplace. I don't think that they're leasing gold anymore. And when you lease gold, the buyer sells it and takes the money, and because they're only paying about 0.5% or 1%, and they go out and make more money doing something else. The thing is, when they have to buy the gold back, it's more expensive. And so they usually don't get that gold back to give back to the lender, which is some central bank, because it's been sold. So they pay them back in dollars or euros or whatever they want. And so the more they sell, the more disappears into the hands of the little people, so to speak. And another thing, too, is that in Western Europe, Canada, the United States, and Mexico, less than 0.1% of the people are buying gold and silver-related assets. They just don't get it. And that's understandable because our last bull market in gold ended toward the end of 1980, and you would have to be over 50 years old, or at least 45 years old, to have participated or known about what was going on. You would have had to be 20 years old, so that's 45 years old approximately. And, you know, how many people 20 knew what was going on? Very few. And so this gold-silver syndrome, we'll call it, so to speak, is unbeknownst to most of the population. They don't know anything about it. They don't know it's a store of value. And so once they catch on, once their houses start going down, once the stock market starts going down, and interest rates start going higher, which they will in time, then they're going to start getting the message.
All right, well, I think they're in for some very, very difficult economic times, and I think people really first got to begin making plans now for this eventuality. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 if you'd like to talk to Bob. You know, I was interested in this last forecaster I read where you commented something I had not heard before. Certainly Russia, you know, has been a basket case economically for many years, but what most people don't understand is that Russia suddenly now is in great shape economically, because until recently, Russia was the second largest exporter of oil. And you pointed out in one of your recent forecasters, if I'm not mistaken, that Russia is now the world's leading exporter of oil, having surpassed Saudi Arabia. Is that really true?
It's absolutely true. And they have $275 billion in foreign exchange and gold, and they've been pitching dollars. They sold almost $6 billion in dollars for either rubles or gold or euros or other things, other currencies, other stores of value. And so they, like Italy, are in the process of dumping dollars, or at least getting a smaller position. And the economy is doing extraordinarily well. They do have very high inflation for that kind of a country. It's between 9% and 10%. They're hoping over the next 3 years to get it down to 4.5% to 5%. And they have a big problem with the amount of credit and money that's available for banks. Their increase in M3 is 43.4%. I know that's hard to believe, but that's what it is. And they started withdrawing credit facilities for banks. They're cutting them back. They started doing it last week. And so they want to clean that mess up and take it, you know, back down to 5 to 10%. And so the Russians are not stupid. And they got all the things like Canada has that everybody wants: oil, gas, natural resources. And they have a sound economy. It could be a lot better because they get left behind quite badly in manufacturing and in some phases of technology because of the Soviet Union and communism. But they're doing quite well, actually. Whether we like it or not, they are.
All right, let's go to Ray, who's calling us from Santa Cruz. And Ray, did you have a question for our guest?
Hi, Dr. Stan. Hi, Bob. Yeah, Bob, my question was, I'm worried about the auto industry, and I'm under the impression now that there is very little manufacturing of automobiles in this country anymore, and I'm afraid that that will be one of the major causes for our swift downfall, you know, if that ever happens. If we don't have, if we're not making automobiles over here anymore, you know, how in the heck can we have any manufacturing at all?
Well, in the next 2 years, we'll lose about 80,000 jobs in manufacturing.
Oh, God.
And almost all of the machine tool jobs will be gone.
Mm.
There will still be manufacturing of automobiles via Nissan and other foreign companies like Toyota. What GM and Ford planned in they planned it earlier in the early 1970s, and they started moving on this project in 1980, was to ship all of their production offshore to cheaper locations, sell into that market as well as ship back cars in the United States, and they could cut their cost of labor down by like 95%. And that's what they're in the process of doing. How many cars they expect to sell back to the United States remains to be seen, in as much as I don't know how many people are going to have any money.
Well, I understand that the Chinese are, you know, they're flooding, they're in the process of flooding our markets with auto market with cheap with cars in China.
I think that starts next year, doesn't it, Bob?
Sometime soon.
Right.
Oh, 07. 300,000.
I think it's really so interesting.
That's frightening.
I think it's really so interesting. The Japanese, Toyota, Honda, Nissan, are actually manufacturing, and I think Hyundai is definitely going to start manufacturing their cars here in the United States. Why are they doing that? Because our wage levels are so much lower than they are in Japan. Of course, there it's everything's been artificially inflated for such a long period of time, so our wage levels are higher than they are in Japan, so it's cheaper for the Japanese to produce their cars here in the United States. But one day it may very well be cheaper for them to produce them in China. General Motors is moving into Brazil, into Mexico. It's the largest automobile producer in China today. It's second or third largest producer in Korea. Now it's moving into India. General Motors is moving throughout the world, and I suspect that Ford will not be far behind. Would that be a fair estimate, Bob?
Yes, Ford's going to Mexico and India. But Mexico is fast losing their edge to the other slave labor countries. And that's not going to diminish. What's going to diminish is the fact that hopefully we will have preventative tariffs, protective tariffs. And if we have that, we can start getting back on a footing again. But once we lose that machine tool business, it's gone. We can never recover as an industrial nation. And when that happens, we're doomed. So I wrote about that for Sadie's issue. And it just, there's no way back.
Because that's exactly what our leaders want. They want to destroy the economy of this nation. They have an intense hatred of America. Their dedication is the globalist dream, the Rockefellers and all of their allies. Anything else, Ray?
Yeah, I saw this happen. I used to work at Hewlett Packard in the semiconductor business, and I saw this happening back in early as 1978. They were shipping all the work out to Penang, you know. It was always Penang or Malaysia or someplace like that. They would do the boards and everything like that, and then they would send it back here to QC them or whatever. That kind of thing. It's been going on for, 25 years now, but only it's accelerating so much now. I'm just afraid the whole thing is just gonna, the whole country is just gonna go right down the drain.
Well, our job, of course, is to get the American people to know what's going on, Ray, and you got to help us. Hey, look, thanks so much for calling.
Yeah.
Bye-bye. All right, and again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295 if you're here in the Central Coast of California. Somebody, of course, had called in and asked your thoughts on the fact that increasing numbers of Americans seem to be moving overseas, trying to get their money out of the country before it collapses. What are your thoughts on that, Bob?
I couldn't quite hear you on that. Could you repeat it, please?
Basically, somebody called in and asked for your thoughts on the fact that an increasing number of Americans are moving out of this country and trying to get their money out of the country. Is there any truth to that?
Oh, yes. It's quite rampant. And Washington is very, very well aware of it. People are buying homes in other countries. They're moving money to other countries. And a lot of people are staying out of the country more than 10 years, and actually they can tax you for what you make up until 10 years after you leave the country, although the government hasn't as yet pursued that except among the rich, and that was a law passed in 1996. But there is a considerable amount of not only assets, but people are leaving the United States. And they're going to all kinds of places. We have a lot of subscribers that have done it. Uruguay, Chile, Mexico, New Zealand, Australia, France. I mean, all kinds of destinations. So it is true. And that's why the government is so intent in trying to corral these assets and keep people from taking them out of the country, because they want to steal them.
Well, I can believe that's true. I mean, certainly the elite, of course, want to enslave the people. They don't want independent people. They don't want a wealthy middle class. They want to impoverish the middle class and have a two-tiered system, the very wealthy and the less common folks.
Well, that's correct. And George Bush and the neocons are the agents of these people, and unfortunately, all too many people in the Republican Party who can't see the forest from the trees, they've got themselves enmeshed in it, and they're going to pay a terrible price because it'll be a long, long time before Republicans get back in power again, if ever.
Well, of course, the tragedy is, of course, that the Democrats, so many of them believe in big government, believe that government can solve our problem. Traditionally, the Republicans believe that the government is our problem. Unfortunately, once they got into power, you couldn't tell a great deal of difference between the Republicans and the Democrats, because George Bush used the Republican Party to pass all sorts of legislation that his good friend, Senator Ted Kennedy, could not get through because of Republican opposition, but George Bush got it through. And, of course, the Republicans have been the biggest spenders. They've created the greatest debt of all time when they control both houses of the legislature. Maybe it's time for a change. Well, Bob, you got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, I think there's been a lot of things in the news to distract people from what's going on in the Middle East. We had our latest, I think, a phony terrorist event. That's my opinion, in England. And all these little mini dingbat attempts at terrorists here and the terrorists there, and then we supposedly catch a murderer or somebody and then they let him go because he didn't do it. Anything to keep Iraq and Afghanistan out of the front pages, and the failures of the Bush administration and the Republicans off the front pages, so to speak. And so you have to be very mindful of what these people are up to. You can't believe a thing that they say because they have a great habit of never telling the truth. And so I think you have to be mindful of what's going on and watch very carefully. And, of course, those of you that get the International Forecaster really get a good handle on it because we cover that twice a week. And we cover it in a way that you can very, very easily understand.
Yes, it's a little, I rather like it having it twice a week. It's, you know, it's not a matter of 50 pages you have to go through. It's only 25 pages or so twice a week. At least it doesn't come all at one time.
Well, we try to do our best, and what we are is truth seekers. Like you are, Stan, and we just try to let the people know exactly what's going on. And quite frankly, I don't know how much longer they'll let you and I do this, because they do have laws now prohibiting what we're talking about.
Well, of course, when they actually clamp down, there's nothing we can do about it. But in the meantime, we need to do everything we can to try to get the American people educated and understanding they're really involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political, ideological and cultural battlefield. But behind this whole move towards the New World Order and the New World Religion and the New World Currency are powerful spiritual forces that are intent upon the destruction of this once great Christian nation that we've been privileged to live in. Well, Bob, do you have a parting thought before I let you go?
If you can, get out of debt, and once you've done that, get yourself some gold and silver related assets, because they're going to be the only thing that's going to save you financially.
Right, of course. And the other thing, of course, make sure that you have a good close relationship with God, because we're going to need every bit of help that we can get for what I believe are the very, very difficult times that lie ahead. Bob Chapman, thanks very much for being with us.
It's always wonderful to be on with you.
Good night.
And I'm looking forward to our next meeting.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Stand back here at Radio Liberty, and I hope you've enjoyed our program with Bob Chapman. I always do, and And Bob is a wonderful source of information. Of course, this is the time when I have to remind our leaders, our listeners, that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we're dependent on those of you who are out there, listen to us, and agree with our message to help us as we reach out 5 hours every day trying to warn the American people what's going on and trying to explain to them how it all fits together. Now, if you'd like to understand what really happened on 9-1-1, and you're not getting it, of course, with the media or through the 9-1-1 commission or through any of the other material that's out there, although there's some very, very good books, let me suggest my pamphlets, the three of them all together. They're rather inexpensive. They're called Foreknowledge 9-1-1. If you'd like to understand the spiritual forces that rule the world, we have a three-pamphlet set called The Occult Hierarchy. If you want to understand genetic engineering and the threat of the new diseases that they are creating to kill off millions, if not hundreds of millions of people, you need to get our pamphlet on genetic engineering. If you'd like to understand the foundation of America, the pamphlet is We Are a Democracy, We Are a Republic. And lastly, of course, if you'd like to understand the finances, why, of course, the pamphlet is on the history of money. All of these are available by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. We do hope that many of you out there will certainly want to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and of course, you can certainly get them in bulk if you'd like to for distribution, but try to get people to read the book, to watch the video or DVD that goes with it. And then, of course, we hope that many of you will want to get many of the other items that we have that go into the spiritual aspect. The Supernatural is a wonderful book. We have, of course, the book Hostage to the Devil, written by Malachi Martin. We have a four-tape set of The Wisdom of Malachi Martin. If you've never read Hostage to the Devil, it was written back in the late 70s or early 80s. I think we first came across it in about 1980. And this is one of the first books that really helped me to begin to understand the other dimension. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, there really is another dimension. There is a supernatural dimension. We have books on alien encounters. We have a book on alien abductions. There really are such things. They're not imaginary. And there really are people who are in contact with that other dimension who serve the ruler of the other dimension. So Hostage to the Devil and the four tape set, The Wisdom of Malachi Martin, you can get actually as a special at a reduced price. We have a four tape set on the supernatural, and of course we carry the book, The Beautiful Side of Evil. That's The Beautiful Side of Evil, and it was written by a woman who was actually a medium. And, of course, she was an apprentice to a psychic healer. People say this really couldn't happen, but it did to Johanna Michelson. You'll hear her interviews. And The Supernatural, you'll hear the, you can read her book. And you begin to understand what this is about. If you have not yet seen the videos, they sold their souls for rock and roll, the 3-hour, the 4-hour, or 10-hour version. They sold their souls for rock and roll. You need to get it. We have also the wonderful video. It's entitled The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning. If you're Catholic and would like to know about occult images, pornographic and obscene images and anti-Christian images in Catholic art, we have a great new DVD. It's actually, I'm in this. It's entitled The Rape of the Soul. It's a rape of the soul. It was a full-length motion picture, and then, of course, it was blocked at every turn. The last thing that the forces of darkness wanted for this to be seen, it was shown in about 12 major markets across America. In many of those theaters, it was playing for up to 9 weeks, and that's an amazing length of time for a film to play. But, of course, everything was done to suppress it. Please pray for America. Pray for revival, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and for our protection. And so until next tomorrow at the same time, when we'll be with you again, may the Lord be with you.
fortune in the city. There are many people laughing wise. There are many people paying attention. There are many now who see the big lie.
Good afternoon, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, wherever you're situated on this great, big, beautiful blue globe floating through the void of Yah's creation. It is Monday, the 28th of August, 2006. And, yep, here we go again, folks. A big storm is brewing, and it's headed somewhere into the Gulf area, Florida. Who knows? And I know that there are lots of folks, lots and lots, gobs, a whole slew of people right now